We're getting close to the end now, but we still have one more part to go. And here I'm gonna be talking mostly about Dreyer's most famous film, La Passion de Jeanne d'Arc, which he made in France, and how it can be said to fit into some of the artistic and stylistic trends in the international art cinema of the 20s. But I think that it's there were also, I think, maybe at least places where Dreyer also had some kind of effect on other filmmakers. This is a somewhat harder to show, but one thing that's been suggested, which I certainly find intriguing, is that Sergei Eisenstein may well have known Dreyer's film Die Gezeichneten from 1922. It was a film that he made in Germany between The Parson's Widow and Once Upon a Time, and at that time, Russian subjects were all the rage. A German-made film by Karl Grüne of Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov had a considerable success, and Dreyer was hired by a production company that wanted him to do a film with sort of a Russian background. And Dreyer then suggested that they might want to adapt a Danish novel called Elsker Hver Andre, which means Love One Another, by a Danish writer named O. Medlung, a novel which had been extremely successful in German translation and sold very widely. And this was then decided on, and Elsker Hver Andre was also the Danish title of the film, whereas the German title means the stigmatized ones, and the stigmatized ones of the title are Russian Jews, and it's a story explicitly about the persecution of Jews in Tsarist Russia. In Russia, the film was distributed as Pogrom, because it sort of climaxes in a big pogrom against the Jews of the small town where most of the story is set. And the film was thought to be lost for many years, until a print turned up in Russia in 1960, and from this print, a dupe negative was made, and a couple of new prints were made from this, and one of them was given to the Danish Film Museum, and they translated the titles of the film back into the Russian titles back into Danish, and distributed the film like that, and then it was this print was shown for many years and got quite worn, and then in order to have a new print, they did a dupe of that print, which meant that all the scratches and imperfections of it were copied in to this new negative, and then a new print was made from that, and by that time the film really looked pretty awful. And so some years back I spoke with Thomas Christensen, the curator at the Danish Film Institute, that we should try to get the film in better shape. And so we sent a letter to the Russian Film Archive. They said, we don't have the film anymore. And that was so. And basically the story stopped there for a while. But then I was at the Cinema di Corato, the festival for rediscovered films in Bologna, where I talked with a French film historian named Bernard Eisenschitz, and we got to talking about Die Gezeichneten, and he said that he was very interested in the film, and I told my sad story that we wanted to restore it, but we couldn't because the original print was lost. No, no, it's not lost. I've seen it. What? Where? In Paris. Paris? And it turned out that at the Bois d'Arcy Film Archive outside Paris, where Thomas and I then went, they did have a nitrate print of Die Gezeichneten, and we opened the box, and you know, there it said in Russian letters, "Pogrom." So it was, and it was tinted and everything, and there it was. And it turned out that what had happened was that the Russian Film Archive, at some years back, had a policy to get rid of all their nitrate material when it had been copied to safety films, and some of the nitrate films were given away to the Cinémathèque de Toulouse, because the Cinémathèque de Toulouse was run by a communist who was quite friendly with Moscow. And so the original print ended up there, and so we were able to go back to that and do a scan of that and get a more respectable looking print of the film. And we also reconstructed the titles on the base of a title list from the Swedish Film Censorship Office, and it turned out that there were about 50 titles that were missing in the Russian print compared to this title list. So this was quite interesting. Anyway, Eisenstein may have did some work on imported films in 1922-23, where he helped put in Russian titles and possibly also in some cases editing the films. And so at least some Eisenstein scholars feel sure that he watched Die Gezeichneten at this time, and that it made an impression, and particularly the sort of the scenes of the persecution of the Jews, and I'll show you a bit from the end of the film, the big pogrom sequence there. It's 1905, and people are marching because the Tsar has granted a limited popular constitution, and the Russians decide to celebrate this by massacring the Jews. The big fellow here with the beard, the really big beard, was an actor from Stanislavski's Moscow Art Theater, as were a number of the other actors involved. Vladimir Gaidarov here was also from the Stanislavski Art Theatre. He also plays the lead role in the Robert Wiene version of Raskolnikov from 2023. And this is Richard Boleslavsky, a third member of the Stanislavski troupe who became a Hollywood director in the 1930s. Anna Bohn, who is an Eisenstein scholar and who worked with Eno Patanas on his reconstruction of the Russian premiere version of Battleship Potemkin in 2003, 2004, 2005, I think it was, is convinced that there is this link between this film and Eisenstein's work, and that the scene in Potemkin where the woman is agitating on the port side next to the corpse of the dead sailor Vakulinchuk, and a nasty bourgeois calls out from the crowd, "Down with the Jews," that this is sort of a reference of sorts to Die Zeichnung. I don't quite see it, but I think it is quite possible that the link is there. But the film that sort of really opened doors for Dreyer in France was because most of his other films didn't get distributed there, was Du skal ære din hustru, Master of the House, from 1925, which was produced by Palladium, the same company that did the Patton Patterson films, And basically, they in 1925 they decided to do a version of Don Quixote with Patton Patterson as Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, which is sort of an obvious thing. This film was shot on location in Spain, and so the studio was vacant, and Dreyer got to do Master of the House there in the meanwhile. It's based on a play. It's a story of a marriage in crisis, a tyrannical husband, and the ill effects that he exerts on the rest of his family, and how he is put in place by when his old nanny moves in and straightens him out. So there are there are clear comedy aspects to the film, but it's also quite psychologically subtle, and it's a film that that Dreyer consciously made as a Kammerspiel, meaning a chamber play, which was sort of a term that was current in Germany, where he'd been working. He'd made first Die Gezeichneten, then he went back to Denmark to do Der Vandgang, then he went to Germany again and did Michael, which is based on a David Danish novel and is a psychological drama of a famous painter and his protege, with whom he is infatuated. It's not sort of an explicitly homosexual romance, but it's not too difficult to see that between the lines, and the author of the source novel, Hermann Bang, was sort of a famously gay writer, also very well known and widely read in Germany. And just before Michael went into production in 1922, this confessional pamphlet that Bang had written was published posthumously by his doctor, where Bang talks in detail about his experience of life as a gay man, and sort of all the self-tortures that occasioned for him. So this was something that was quite that the people at the time were quite aware of. But Michael is also sort of a story that takes place in mostly inside these apartments. They're very grand and big apartments, but it's still sort of a story about psychological tensions between a relatively small number of people. And so it was considered to be part of sort of a trend in German cinema at the time for this kind of intimate psychological drama. And in the theater, you had the term Kammerspiel, which came from this intimate stage that Max Reinhardt had set up in 1907, I think, which was called Kammerspiel, and which was the first sort of really small intimate theater, which was used to stage modern psychological drama. And so this sort of idea was taken over in film, and this was a trend that Dreyer clearly approved of, and Master of the House was consciously done along the same lines. And nearly the entire film takes place inside this one small apartment. It's a small two-room apartment, and it's very much sort of a drama of everyday life. Here is the beginning of the film. Right, this is actually... you may have noticed here at the end when the father comes in and sits down, that the round table that he sits down at is right next to the wall of the apartment. Where, but in previous shots, we've seen at the beginning when we see the mother coming in and lighting the fire, we see the camera placed on the other side of the room, and we have that same table sitting there in the foreground, a little bit away from the camera. We've actually sort of here at the end, we get a camera placement somewhere where we've already seen there is a wall. We probably don't notice that as things are moving along, but the sets that was constructed for the film was a four-wall set where the walls were wild walls, as it's called in America, so that they could be moved out of the way and the camera placed in various positions in relation to the very small space of the apartment. So the dimensions of the set were copied from an actual two-room apartment in the neighborhood where the story is supposed to take place. But in order to facilitate camera placement, the walls could be moved out of the way and the camera put in various positions in relation to the characters. And this was a way of working that Dreyer had probably first started out with on Die Gezeichneten. At least the set designer on Die Gezeichneten, Jens Lind, was interviewed in the 1950s, and he talked about how they had these openings in the walls of the sets that allowed shooting from various angles, and this was something that continued to work with, and as we shall see, this is also something that he uses quite extensively in Passion of Joan of Arc. But that does mean that it's what you get is sort of a different kind of space from an American film, where in the American cinema by this time the 180 degree rule was well established, so that you would have the camera only on one side of the characters, so that when people look either to the left or to the right, the directions are consistent across shots. And Dreyer instead preferred to be able to place his camera wherever he thought that it gave the best view of the actors, and then allow screen direction to sort itself out if necessary. And of course, with a really sort of intimate situation like the one we see in Master of the House, the sort of the layout of the room is quite clear, and we're, even though screen direction may change from shot to shot, it's not confusing, but also of course the focus remains on the characters and their reactions. And as you may also have noticed, it's a very brisk moving film. It's cut very rapidly. We shift back and forth between the characters and from room to room and from situation to situation. Even though sort of editing speeds had increased generally, this one is cut much faster than any other Danish film of the period. And on the strength of this film, Dreyer was brought to France and hired by the Société Générale de Film. Master of the House was extremely successful in France. In French archives, there are actually four different original prints, original nitrate prints of the film. So we know that at least four copies of it circulated in French cinemas at the time, and maybe more. There were indeed four cinemas in Paris that were showing the film at the same time. It got glowing reviews, and that certainly helped. The Société Générale de Film had completed Abel Gance's huge historical spectacle Napoleon. It had been started by another company called Visti, but that had gone bankrupt, not because of Napoleon, but for other reasons. And the Société Générale de Film had picked up the pieces and completed the film, and they then turned to Dreyer to do this big budget film on Joan of Arc. In Christian Thompson's and David Bordwell's film history and introduction, and I've managed to get it from the Czech edition here, you may notice, there is a section on how Passion of Joan of Arc draws on other artistic traditions within cinema, and it's illustrated with this still where it says mismatched windows in the courtroom set of The Passion of Joan of Arc recall Hermann Wahm's earlier career in German expressionist filmmaking. Hermann Wahm was a set designer who had worked on Das Kabinett des Dr. Caligari and a number of other high-profile German films, and he was hired to do the sets for Passion de Jeanne d'Arc along with Jean Hugo, who was, I think, the grandson of Victor Hugo. And Thompson and Bordwell's argument is that sort of the stylization that we see in the sets in some sense a something that Wahm brought with him from his expressionist background. However, in the collection of the Danish, and here we can see more clearly these mismatched windows. It's very evident that they're different in size, and that the little, I don't know what the English word for the sort of the pieces of lead that holds the little pieces of glass together is, but anyway, you can see that they're quite irregular, and I mean, even though medieval architecture will sometimes show this irregularities, you know, you don't usually get something as blatant as this, and it certainly gives a strongly stylized feel to this set, which is the set where the first interrogation, which takes up the first 15 minutes or so of the film, is set. However, in the collection of the Danish Film Museum in Copenhagen, we have Wahm's sketches for this set, and if we look at the windows, they're actually pretty regular. They don't have this sort of blatant stylization about them that we find in the finished set. Now, we don't know whether this was or who was responsible for this change, but it does certainly suggest the possibility that I mean, certainly what Wahm initially came up with was something which was a bit more regular and realistic, and that perhaps it was Dreyer who said no, they should be more sort of wild like that. We can see them up close here. They're a little offset, but not by any means as much as the windows in the film. Part of this may have been Dyer was clearly wanted the sets to resemble some of the architectural illustrations in medieval manuscripts. There is one manuscript in particular, a manuscript of the Travels of Marco Polo, which was done, I think, 15 years before the death of Joan of Arc in the beginning of the 15th century. And the exterior sets in particular are very, very clearly based on the drawings or the miniature paintings in this manuscript, and the stylization of the sets that you see there is something that is echoed by the manuscript. And it's something that Dreyer has also talked about, that he wanted to sort of try to emulate the visual feel of these illustrations by having and one of the striking things about these illustrations is that while the buildings and so on are quite strongly stylized, the figures, the people that you see in the pictures, are much more realistically done. And Dreyer wanted sort of the same contrast, that he wanted real-looking people, but stylized sets. But so it's perhaps not as clear I think that sort of the idea that there is sort of a direct inspiration from Expressionism is somewhat questionable, but certainly Expressionism had sort of opened up the possibility of doing strongly stylized sets. And even though Dreyer's sets are arguably stylized in a different way than Expressionism is, you can still say that this idea of using strong stylization in the sets is something that he drew from there. Another sort of artistic trend that had been influential was that in France, you had the what has sometimes been referred to as the Impressionist movement. That there was a group of filmmakers who made commercial films that used various kinds of devices, particularly to express experimental devices, particularly to present character subjectivity. And whereas you could say that the German films were very that they thought a lot about, that the sets was where the experiments were going on, and that they made they gave great importance to set designers. In France, it was these subjectivizing effects were much more a question of camera work and editing. Partly because France, at least at the beginning of the 20s, didn't have modern studio facilities that compared to the ones in Germany at all. So French films were, to a much greater degree than German ones, shot outside and on location, partly because of the lack of proper studio facilities. But this idea of using various kinds of photographic tricks and often quite rapid editing to suggest sort of a mental crisis of some sort in characters is something that we find in a number of French films at the time. And sort of a famous example is Epstein's Cœur Fidèle from 1923, where the heroine has been taken away by this man she does not love, and her boyfriend has followed, but she's desperately sad because she has been separated from him and is in the power of this rather violent and unpleasant man, and she and the man who's taken her away go to this fair in a small town, and Epstein uses rapid cutting to sort of emphasize her sort of mental discombobulation. So Epstein uses both rapid cutting and a camera mounted on moving platforms of various sorts, but also odd framings occasionally where combined with brief shots makes it a little difficult to see exactly what you're getting, and you get sort of this relatively empty shot and then this sort of swing goes into the shot, and and leaves it again, which is sort of kind. It's not really sort of an optimal view of that swing, but the point is again precisely not to show the swing, but to express the mental state of the character. But this use of fast cutting, close-ups, framings that are sort of odd and don't really give an optimal view of what is going on is something that we can find also in Passion of Joan of Arc, particularly in sort of the towards the middle of the film, after Joan has first been interrogated in the large chapel. She's then interrogated again in a small cell. But when she obstinately persists in sticking with her claim that she's on a divine mission, the interrogation are then moved to the torture chamber, and she is threatened with torture in order to get her to sign a document where she admits that the visions she believes she had weren't really sent from God, but were fraudulent. I think she's ready to sign the abjuration document. Church opens its bosom for you. If you turn away, it will cast you out and leave you alone. Alone. even if you tear the soul from my body, I will take nothing back. And if I should happen to do it anyway, I'll say afterwards that you forced me to do it. I mentioned that Dreyer did this list in the 60s of his top inspirations, and with Sjöström's The Son of Ingmar there, the modern chapter of Intolerance. Another Swedish film Stiller's Sir Honest Treasure, and a French film Concubine, which is a social drama of a rag picker, about a rag picker, and Lubitsch unfortunately lost Die Flamme, but then three Soviet films, Potemkin, Pudovkin's Mother, and Eisenstein's Ivan the Terrible, and then finally Olivier's Henry V, and the Japanese director Tenosuke Kinugasa's, or Kinugasa Tenosuke, it should be, Jigokumon, which means Gate of Hell. And the last two are certainly films that he has on there because they were major important color films, and at the time he wanted very badly to do Gertrude in color, but the production company said that would be too expensive, so he had to do it in black and white. But he did think a lot about how to use color in film, and both Henry V and Jigokumon are films that were and are remarkable for their very bold and also rather stylized use of color. But here I think that it's perhaps most relevant to look at Potemkin and Mother, because there is some evidence that these films were important for Dreyer when he was making Passion of Joan of Arc. Of course, these were Bolshevik films, and so they were banned by the French censors, but we know Dreyer has later talked about that he saw Potemkin at a closed performance in France and was very, very impressed by it, except for its political tendency. And Mother was also shown in Paris in a couple of closed performances, which were arranged by Antonin Artaud, the famous surrealist, drama theorist, and who is also the young, wistful-looking monk with the dark hair, who has this strong sympathy towards Joan of Arc. So He arranged the screening of Mother while during the summer of 1927, during the shooting of the film. And we know that Dreyer shot the film in sequence, which was part of the reason why it ended up being as expensive as it was, because he thought that it would make it easier for the actors to get into their roles if the film was shot in sequence. And of course that meant that all the actors playing clergymen had to, you know, keep coming back for months to have the tops of their head shaved for the sort of a clerical tonsure. And of course Artaud, who was part of this surrealist group who were fanatically anti-clerical, got a lot got teased a lot by his friends because he, you know, he had to look like a monk for months on end. But this showing of Mother was held in Paris during the summer, and sort of the last part of the film, where Joan is led to the stake, wasn't shot till November, December of 27, and it does contain a shot that I've sort of always thought was a rather strikingly odd shot. Here, Joan is led to the stake. Dear, dear Jesus, I'm so happy to die. Suffer for too long. Can I be with you in paradise tonight? And then you get this. Of course, during this final sequence, Dreyer continuously cuts away from Joan and her pyre to shots of the various onlookers in place, which is reasonable enough. But I mean, this shot of the suckling babe is still somewhat strikingly unusual. You don't get many shots like that in 20s films at all. And I mean, it's certainly possible to think up various sorts of symbolic interpretations. But one thing that struck me was that towards the end of Mother, Pudovkin has a very similar shot. Oh. Now, of course, this and what in you know in what follows, there's this the big demonstration, and the Tsarist soldiers come and kill everyone, and but the revolution still survives, and so on. But the interesting thing is that Dreyer seems to have wanted to have the same sort of sequence in Joan. And one really interesting thing is that in the fall of 1926, when he had been hired by Société Générale de Film, but when they were still talking about what he should do, what he really wanted to do was to film a Danish novel from 1908 called The Palace of the Microbes, a very sort of strange and little-known novel, which has this cover, which is very striking, but which has absolutely nothing to do with the novel itself. Because the novel is about a Russian battleship during the Russian-Japanese War that travels from its harbor in St. Petersburg all the way around Europe and Africa and through the Indian Ocean, all the way to the Straits of Tsushima, where the Imperial Russian Navy was completely destroyed in a big naval battle with the Japanese. And it's this sort of story of mounting doom and mutiny and sickness and everything. And Dreyer really wanted to film this, and I don't know, it seems, you know, when and in his correspondence with the writer Kohl, he has included some reviews of the German translation of the book, which explicitly referred to Potemkin, because the book, it was from 8, but it came out in Germany right around the same time that Potemkin came out in the cinemas. And so it would seem that Dreyer, what he really wanted to do in 1926 was to make his own film about a Russian battleship. And he had the people at the Société Générale de Film try to borrow a battleship from the French Navy, because obviously he needed a battleship to do this. And since the story involved a mutiny, the French Navy absolutely refused to have anything to do with this. So he writes to Kohl, "Well, I'll probably have to do this Shendak thing after all. Damn." Which is you know really fascinating that it was actually something that he was quite reluctant to do, and that what he really wanted, I think, was to do his own Potemkin. But of course here he is on on the set. The ending of the film, after Joan has perished in the flames, the people rise up in rebellion and are brutally dealt with by the English soldiers, who are ultimately responsible for the death of Joan. And the interesting thing is that although the rest of the film is very, very closely based on the historical records of the trial of Joan of Arc, and until up until her conviction, nearly all the intertitles are more or less directly taken from the trial documents, although they have been sort of transposed into dialogue, whereas the trial documents are not verbatim records, but still they're very, very close to it. All the records of Joan's end tell the same story, that she was burnt and then everyone went away quietly. And Dreyer apparently decided that, you know, that and he wanted actually to, in the screenplay, the film ends with the fire dying down and Joan's heart being found unburnt in the ashes, and there is a legend to that effect, and the film was supposed to end with a title about her heart being tossed into the River Seine. And one can see why that wouldn't really work. instead of just having everyone go away quietly, he decided to have a revolution instead. Which also sort of includes some really violent images that I think are similar to the ones that we find in Russian films. For instance, in this brief bit here, we have a little boy finding his mother dead. Now this second to last shot here, with the cannon is also kind of interesting, because as I'm sure Dreyer knew, because he researched these things quite extensively, although there were cannon in the 15th century, it couldn't turn. cannon. Were, you know, basically just big tubes of lead or bronze, and when they were fired, they were buried in the ground so that they wouldn't sort of fly away from the recoil, or mounted in these very, very heavy wooden frames. So it was impossible for them to turn like this, but of course it's a striking effect, and I don't know, it may remind us of turning cannon elsewhere. This is of course from Potemkin. Eisenstein doesn't actually have sort of a shot exactly like this, with the sort of the camera being sort of turning along with the barrel of the gun, but it sort of seems like a reasonable connection. Okay, but I think that still, while Dreyer took in these various elements, he sort of mixed them together into this completely unique concoction, and part of sort of part of the aesthetic strategy that that makes Joan unique is also this use of. Of space and that is facilitated through through the use of these wild walls. And if we go back to Vam's sketch of the sets for the opening parts of the film, it says down here, en rouge, les parties mobiles, in red, the mobile sections. And if we look closely, we can see that all these parts of the sets, all of the walls, are actually marked as red. So that most of the set would have been able to be moved out of the way in this fashion. It's the original sketch is on the Danish Film Institute's Dreyer website, carlthdreyer.dk. If you look under Passion de Chandak, you can find this, and as well as Vam's sketches for the other sets there. Here we go. No, we don't. Being uncooperative, I'm afraid, but it should be there. Here we go. Okay, so this is the after the introductory shots showing the manuscript. This is the first shot that we get where we have the camera tracking behind this podium where the judges are sitting. And if you remember the sketch, you could see that the podium actually goes up all the way to the wall. And when we cut to the other side, where the bishop who's running the trial is seen, we can see that the podium is indeed right up against the wall, so that the moving camera here is on the other side of the wall, which has then been moved away for the purposes of this shot. So you can see the wall is right behind them there.
Away.
Here is the sequence, and I want to sort of call your attention to the baptismal fountain over there in the corner, because that's also sort of a useful orientation point. It's marked on the sketch where you can see it's placed there in the corner, and when you get to the end of the interrogation where Joan is led out, it's also visible there through the door, and that one is here. Perhaps God has promised to release you from prison. When? Mm. I know neither day nor hour. Clergyman goes to the English Duke, and then we cut to this shot on the other side of them. We can see the podium in the background right up against the wall, but we can also but the tracking shot here, when she doesn't want to confess willingly, we'll have to get it out of her. She moves here, and they walk out there. They're also the tracking shot that follows them is also one that uses the mobile walls to allow the camera to be placed sort of closer to us, actually, than the baptismal fountain. And this actually makes for a very confusing space. And I think that one thing that reveals that quite clearly is this diagram. And it's taken from a book by a Danish scholar named Edwin Kau, who's done these very, very, very careful and detailed aesthetic analyses of all Dreyer's films, and this is sort of his attempt to map out what goes on in this sequence. But he hasn't really taken into account the moving walls, and so we get this line here suggesting that the camera moves between the podium and the wall, which it actually doesn't, and he also places the doorway, the entrance there, and there only. And of course, the door that Joan was let out through in the sequence we just saw, where you can see the baptismal fountain over in the other corner, that must clearly be there. But that's if we look at Vam's drawing, the doorway is in a different place. It's there in the end wall, if we look at sort of the elevation of it in Vam's sketch, we can also see that it's designed as a double door. And the one that she's let out through is just a single door, and so this might mean that this door was then dropped for the final set, but that would be wrong. Instead, the little door that she's let out of was added after the drawing was completed, but this big double door is still there. So if we here she's being let out through the little door, and then we cut to the other side. And if we look closely on the edge of the image, we can actually see the big door over there at the very edge. And this door appears in an earlier shot, where we can see quite clearly that it's a very tall double door with iron fittings, which is quite different from the little one. So I mean, even Edwin Kau, who has studied the sequence really, really closely, missed the presence of this door entirely in his sketch. And I'm not, you know, saying that to make fun of his work, but rather using this, I think that it serves to show just how confusing the space in Passion of Joan of Arc is, and how difficult it is to sort of make a geographical sense of it. And I think that that is sort of that's a very important part of what makes Passion of Joan of Arc such an unusual film, is that it allows it sort of takes away our geographical orientation to a really, really surprising degree, and lets sort of the whole of the action take place in a space that's defined psychologically by the relation between the characters and the conflicts between the characters only, and sort of abstracting away any real space at all, and that's a tremendously difficult thing to carry out without creating confusion and dislike among spectators. And I think that it's a testament to the power of Dreyer's vision and his filmmaking skills that he could carry off this sort of almost complete elimination of spatial sense, and still present us with something which is entirely psychologically gripping and involving. And with that, I will call this to a close, and thank you very much for your attention.